65,498 square miles. We've got a lot to cover, so let's get to it. This is Spanning the State, and here are your hosts, Kristen Bry and Brian Noonan.
Well, that's a 50-50 proposition. Kristen is not here today. She'll be back tomorrow. I was not here Friday. I'm back today. I know, it gets very confusing sometimes on Spanning the State, but we're glad you're here, or I'm glad you're here. I'm sure Kristen would be glad you're here, too. Big show today. Later on this hour, we're going to talk to Howard Schwaber from University of Wisconsin-Madison. A lot of people saying that the courts are at a point of constitutional crisis. Are the courts becoming more irrelevant under the Trump administration? We'll talk a little bit about that after 1:30. And then, if you've ever worked a job where you worked for tips, you are going to want to hear this. We are going to talk to the president of One Fair Wage at 2:35 to talk about a big push that they got on last week tonight with John Oliver a couple of weeks ago, what exactly they're working on, and debunk or prop up some of the worries and rumors around tipping and changing how we tip in America. But first of all, how's your bracket? It is, man, it was a crazy college sports weekend, and I was here for most of it. I don't know if they said I was out Friday because I was getting another toe procedure. So it's very, very exciting for me to be back in a surgical shoe today, hobbling around. But so that meant Saturday I was relaxing, watching basketball all day. Yesterday I was watching basketball. So keeping track on my brackets, probably like you, I fill my bracket out, and then within an hour I forget who I've picked other than who I've got to win the whole thing. But I knew I had Marquette at least advancing out of the first round. I had the Badgers going to the Sweet 16. As you know, both of those schools let us down, because I know here in the building there were a lot of sad people over the weekend based on Marquette and Marquette losing to 10th seed New Mexico. I know part of the charm of March Madness is the upsets. I'm not a fan of it. I didn't pick any upsets this year, and it's coming back to bite me. So Marquette lost to New Mexico. Wisconsin lost to BYU. That was a closer game. Came down to one basket. So those lost me. But for me, this is pretty good. I'm sure your brackets are much Brad, your brackets are probably doing better than mine. Mine is at 63.6% correct picks. So that's not bad for me. You know, if I was one of the guys over at ESPN or Jen Latta or any of the really sports enthusiasts, they're probably mocking a 63-64% pick rate. But listen to this. You know, the women's tournament is going on now too, and I filled out a bracket for the ladies. Because, Rhea, you know this, there's nothing I know more than the ladies. I am an expert when it comes to all things lady. My bracket in the ladies category, 95.6. I am almost perfect in the women's bracket. No ladies have let me down with sneaky upsets. All the ladies that I counted on have come through. So together, the ladies and I, once again, inseparable.
I've heard that's almost impossible to have a perfect bracket.
Oh, it is. There's that. I'm surprised. Now, this is how yesterday my women's bracket was 99 something. So somebody lost.
Yeah.
And screwed me up. But I'm still 95%. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. And if you're saying, Brian, enough with the basketball, we'll be updating March Mammal Madness later in the week, see how our brackets are doing there. And then you heard Jessica talk about this in sports during the news. Wisconsin, the Lady Badgers, a thrilling overtime win over Ohio State to capture their eighth national championship in hockey. Pretty good. They won 4-3 in overtime. Junior forward Kristen Sims scored a game-tying goal on a penalty shot with only 18.9 seconds left in regulation. And then just to really rub it into Ohio State, she also netted the game winner in overtime. So good for her. Congratulations. This was the third consecutive national championship game between Wisconsin and Ohio State. Each team had won one of the previous matchups, so now Wisconsin has the edge, 2-1 in their matchups with Ohio State. So women's hockey, congratulations to the Badgers on that. All right. When we come back, you know we've talked about this a lot, that on April 1st, there is an election in Wisconsin. Yes, I know, another one. Didn't we just vote on things? Yes, but this one, we've got the DPI superintendent, we've got a ballot referendum, and then we've also got the Supreme Court justice race, which we have been hearing so much about. Well, there's something that makes this election a little different than other Supreme Court elections, and that is the nationalization of it. So we're going to talk about that, and who are you voting for? Are you voting for not the candidate, but are you voting for a candidate, or are you voting for or against a bigger situation? We'll get to all of that and more. It's Spanning the State. You can't. It's Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan. Kristen will be back with us tomorrow. So I'm reading the Journal Sentinel today, and I come across a piece by Craig Gilbert. It was a special to the Journal Sentinel, and it was about the Supreme Court race here in Wisconsin. And you know the election is, again, coming up on April 1st. If you get a postcard that says April 11th, as we talked about the other day, set that on fire and curse the person who sent it to you. But April 1st is the Supreme Court election, and this election has gone into kind of uncharted territory. Now, we're used to outside money coming into Wisconsin elections. We're used to, especially since the last Supreme Court race, a lot of attention being on that race. We're used to Wisconsin getting a lot of attention during presidential and national campaigns because of its purple status. But this has turning into, and it has already become, the most expensive and partisan race in state history. It's the first time both sides have worked so hard to nationalize a spring judicial election. And what does that mean? Well, it means when you go into when you either vote absentee, when you go in early vote, when you go into the polling place, they're hoping that you will not so much vote for one of the two candidates, but vote for the party that's backing them. Are you voting for or against this administration? Are you voting for or against a Democratic justice being put on the court? That's the big question, and that's what makes this election so much different. So we know Elon Musk has donated a lot. He spent more than $12 million on this election, the biggest and most divisive super donor to ever be here. So, you know, we've talked to Steve Scafidi about this. We've talked to other people about this. Will there, and there's no way to know yet, but you can jump in anytime on the Siding Unlimited WTMJ Talk and Text line at 855-616-1620. Is your vote going to be anti-Elon Musk? Has he done enough to make you upset about this? Now, listen, there's money coming in on the Democratic side, too. We know George Soros-based money is coming in. But Elon, very divisive. So this is turning into, and it has become, based on the presidential election and Donald Trump's second term, we are, whether we want to admit it or not, the most polarized electorate that has ever been. So in Marquette's most recent Wisconsin poll, 90% of Republican voters had a positive view of Donald Trump. Won't surprise you then that 99% of Democratic voters had a negative view. That's the biggest partisan split that has ever been recorded in Marquette polls history. And that's 13 years they've been doing these polls. So what both sides are thinking is, because of that divisiveness, because of that nationalization, voter turnout is going to be key. And we talk about voter turnout always being key. And usually there's, you know, low, distressingly low voter turnout. No matter what side you're on, you want more people coming out to vote. And that doesn't always happen. Now, we know that the last Supreme Court race, the turnout was high. And a lot of the reason was because of the, at that point, the recent overturning of Roe versus Wade and all of that. Well, now we've got other things happening. And so this has become what has been described as a two-track election. So on one level, there's a traditional judicial race, because that's really what we're doing. We're still in Wisconsin. We're voting for a Supreme Court justice that is going to make decisions based only in Wisconsin on the laws here and national laws that we have to follow in Wisconsin. That's what this person is going to do. We're not electing a Supreme Court justice to go to Washington and hear cases there. So it's still really a statewide local election. So there's that. And we should, I feel, be looking at the strengths and weaknesses of the candidates, not believing all the hot take political ads that we hear, not only here on WTMJ, but on the TV, anywhere, you know, take those with a grain of salt, because you've all heard, by the time you've become an adult, you've heard hundreds of thousands of political ads. And most of them are just attack ads. So you kind of roll with it. So we have that old school election where we should be just looking at the candidates and trying to decide who's going to do the job better based on whatever research you do, based on your gut feeling, all of that. But then there's another track. And it's based on this current administration. And it's partisan on steroids. One of the keys to this election is going to be how you feel about Elon Musk, and how you feel about all the money that's coming in. It might be how you feel about money in general. It might be how you feel about the president. But it's going to be up to both sides to get out the vote and get people moving. So both sides are out there. Just, I don't know, good luck. And don't be, here's, all right, there's a couple things we're going to get to after. Just two more things on this. And then we're going to talk about the courts, because, you know, I like to keep it light on a Monday. We've had a whole weekend. So we'll talk a little bit more about this. And then there's more. It's Spanning the State. It's Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan. All right, we were talking about the nationalization of our Supreme Court election on April 1st, and I was asking you, are you voting for a candidate, or are you voting for a bigger issue? Are you voting against Elon Musk and the current administration? Are you voting for something that you think Brad Schimmel will do when he's on the Supreme Court? Some of the text, Norm from Racine is voting for the one that doesn't think judges make the law. Wouldn't you hope that that was all of them? And I guess they have tax referendums on the ballots in Racine too. Jeff says he's voting for the one that is most opposed to legalized recreational marijuana, because he's smelling it everywhere, and he will not call it cannabis. All right, Jeff, that's all right. And other people are saying that they will vote for the one with the best character. I think we should focus on that, but it's hard not to feel like this election has taken on a much bigger scope when the president comes out over the weekend and endorses Brad Schimmel. He was on his social media platform, which you know is Truth Social, and he attacked Susan Crawford, calling her, quote, the handpicked voice of the leftists who are out to destroy your state and our country. And if she wins, the movement to restore the nation will bypass Wisconsin All voters who believe in common sense should, capital letters, get out to vote early for Brad Schimmel. Well, I don't know if that'll help, because Brad Schimmel doesn't seem to trust the outcome of the election, which hasn't happened yet. In case you're not looking at your calendar, today is March 24th, and the election is April 1st. But Brad Schimmel, going back to the Republican playbook of, if I don't win, everything was fixed, he raised the specter of bags of ballots and fraud in Milwaukee elections, despite the well-documented reason that the city's absentee ballots are routinely reported late into the night because they're counting them. He said, quote, "That's what we need to do, get our votes banked, make this too big to rig so we don't have to worry about it at 11:30 in Milwaukee. They're going to find bags of ballots that they forgot to put into the machines like they did in 2018 or in 2024 when Eric Hovde was ahead all night, and then all of a sudden, Milwaukee County changed that." Is anybody else tired of this old song and dance that if I didn't win, it's because we cheated? But amazingly, when my side wins, everything is hunky-dory. Just do it and, or, well, whatever. You know the vote is, you know the election is April 1st. Get out and vote for whoever you want to vote for. Just go and vote. Are the courts becoming irrelevant under the new administration? Well, we are going to find out when Howard Schwaber joins us on the other side of the news. Welcome back to Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan. Kristen will be back with us tomorrow. You've been hearing this story for the last week or so, despite two federal judges blocking the use of the Alien Enemies Act. The Trump administration sent 261 people to El Salvador last weekend. CBS News reported that 137 of those individuals were deported using the 18th century law, the Alien Enemies Act. Some legal experts have called it a new phase of rolling national constitutional crisis. The administration ignored the judge's orders and defied two different federal court orders. So the biggest one that we heard about, the first one, was U.S. District Judge James Boasberg. He explicitly told the Trump administration to turn the planes around before landing in El Salvador. The administration, as I mentioned, ignored his orders and actually defied those orders. I wanted to get some legal insight on what's been happening, not only in this case, but a lot of things happening with the judicial system. So I've turned to our favorite legal guest, Howard Schwaber, professor emeritus of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. Howard, I'm sure, first of all, thanks for being here. I'm sure this is keeping you busy, all of these machinations of the court and the administration.
Well, thank you for having me, and yeah, it kind of is. we need to put the issue of the deportations into a slightly larger context.
Okay.
Which is the general strategy the Trump administration is using to challenge the judiciary. And it has several prongs, but the short version goes like this. First, there are a whole series of laws not involving deportation. Most of these are the issues involving things like firing federal employees. There are a whole series of laws in that area that the Trump administration is perfectly upfront about saying, yeah, we're defying those laws. We're breaking those laws. We're just not going to follow them. And their reasoning is, we don't think those laws are constitutional. We think they represent an unacceptable limitation on the discretion of the executive, the president. And we think that when these cases reach the U.S. Supreme Court, they will rule in our favor on those questions, and then this will all be okay. So that's category one, let's call it, the deliberate attempt to foment a constitutional challenge and a change in constitutional doctrine. In this case, one that's been in place for 90 years, so it's quite a long-standing set of precedents. The second category has to do with district court judges, and here the story gets a little more complicated. So there have been an enormous number of injunctions and orders from district court judges limiting the Trump administration's efforts to do various things that it wants to do. The simple reason for that, well, the Trump administration says the reason for that is that all these judges are partisan leftist Democrats, or in the words of President Trump, left-wing lunatics.
Right.
The judges themselves respond that no, the reason there are so many of these orders is that the Trump administration is doing so many things no one's ever tried to do before, some of which seems so obviously illegal.
Now, and Howard, let me jump in. Let me interrupt real quick. This is nothing new that federal district court judges, they did it to Obama. They did it to Biden. They do it routinely. But to your point,
absolutely,
the amount is due to how much the Trump administration is putting out there.
Well, that's the simplest explanation. It is absolutely true that district court judges, any district court judges, the lowest level of federal court, a trial court, has the authority to issue an injunction that tells the parties in front of us, in front of it, stop doing X or Y, right? That's a simple power of any court. When that party is the federal government, the order by that lower court judge binds the entire national government. And for years, in fact, decades, conservatives and liberals alike have railed against this facet of our system. Listeners might recall during Obamacare and DACA, during the Obama administration, when those two issues were front and center, district court judges in places like Texas ordered the whole federal government to stop doing one or the other of those things until the matter could reach the U.S. Supreme Court and be determined finally. And that's where we are in a lot of these cases. But there's two additional pieces, and they're both, well, troubling, but also interesting. One, in a different context, specifically, people will remember Trump issued an executive order overturning birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment. I know this is a lot to keep track of, but that's how they're playing.
Yes, exactly. No, it's coming fast and furious every day.
It is. So if you remember that birthright citizenship controversy, that one is before the Supreme Court. And what's interesting is that the Trump administration didn't really spend a lot of time in its written arguments saying, oh, we should be allowed to do this. Oh, this is a good ruling. They used the opportunity to say, hey, Supreme Court, you should tell all district courts everywhere that they do not have the authority to issue a ruling that binds the whole federal government, which would be a radical change, but it's one that the Trump administration is seeking. And as I said before, it's one that both Democrats and Republicans have wanted in previous cases.
Why has it never gone through in previous administrations and previous cases?
Well, because courts are very jealous of their authority, and the Supreme Court thinks of itself as part of the court system. You know, we have a system of checks and balances. We have a basic principle that no one, including the executive branch, is above the law, and we have a basic principle that it's up to courts to interpret what the law is. So, you know, the logic of that kind of just follows that the federal government is another party in a lawsuit just like anybody else and doesn't have special prerogatives that make it different under the law or the Constitution. The new argument from the Trump administration is exactly that, that because of the nature of the executive branch, uniquely it should be exempted from rulings by trial courts. And in the past, courts have never had any sympathy for arguments of that kind. And frankly, people haven't really had the audacity to make them because it's such an extreme argument.
Right.
One of the things that's characteristic of the Trump administration, aside from the things that it does, the legal arguments that it raises are frequently, indeed consistently, arguments that are as recently as a couple of years ago would have been considered fringe.
But now they're considered just everyday occurrences?
So this is where we get to the thing that's troubling.
Yeah.
There was yesterday, the Trump administration filed an emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. This one had to do with an order from a district court judge, that's the lowest level of federal judge, in San Francisco, telling them they couldn't proceed with firings across certain categories of employees. What the Trump administration said to the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday was, look, that ruling was made on February 28th. It's almost a month later. The Ninth Circuit has still not responded to the appeal. Please step in. And the Trump administration has a point. Trial court judges have been very active, but the courts of appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court have pretty much yet to say anything.
Okay.
We're all waiting to hear from the U.S. Supreme Court. And as our conversation suggests, the lists of questions and the importance of the questions that are piling up and remain unanswered is becoming, you know, really extraordinary. Last point is, of course.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. What's the last point?
Well, the last point is that on a lot of these things, delay means there's no possibility of reversal. If a year from now it is ruled the deportation of these Venezuelans was unlawful, or the firing of federal employees was unlawful, right, or any of those things, so what?
Yeah.
When that much time has gone by, undoing those actions becomes difficult, if not impossible. And so that's yet another piece of this strategy. Courts, by their nature, move slowly. The Trump administration, by its character, is moving very, very fast. And so we may not see a direct defiance, you know, the kind of classic constitutional crisis situation was when President Andrew Jackson said to the Supreme Court, well, you've issued a ruling, let's see you enforce it, and just ignore them. in the case involving Indian rights called Lister versus Georgia.
Well, that's what I want to get to you when we come back. We've got to take a quick break. That term has been thrown around a lot over the last couple of days. Constitutional crisis. I want to get your opinion on that. Howard Schwaber is my guest. He's professor emeritus of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. More after this on Spanning the State. Back on Spanning the State, my guest, Howard Schwaber, the professor emeritus of political science and law at UW-Madison. All right, Howard, so over the weekend, a lot of stories coming out, a lot of people on the Sunday morning shows tossing around the term constitutional crisis. How do you describe a constitutional crisis, and are we there yet?
So there's no technical definition, but for me, and this is just an opinion, I think the point of crisis is when the Constitution's mechanisms have ceased to function. So that would happen, for example, if the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Trump administration could not do something, let's say fire employees, and the Trump administration said, we don't care, we aren't bound by the courts at all.
Okay.
That would be an actual crisis. I don't think we're there yet, although I certainly have sympathy for people who think we're coming closer and closer. In fact, the Trump administration and Trump himself have not outright defied a court order. They've dodged them, they've disputed them, they've appealed them, they've engaged in some sketchy maneuvers and some questionable representations to try and justify their actions. But every time push comes to shove, Trump and his senior people, when they're asked, you know, the second time, did you really mean to say you would defy a court order, have backed down and said, no, we won't do that. Most recently, Holman and Homeland Security. So I don't think we're there yet. I think there are one of three outcomes, and I think the Trump administration is banking on the first two. One is the Supreme Court may very well bless many of the things that the Trump administration is doing, even though they are radical. And the reason is, this is a pretty radical Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
The Roberts Court over the past 10 years has made big moves in exactly the direction that the Trump administration wants, that is, consolidating authority in the executive and limiting the ability of both Congress, well, especially Congress, to restrict the executive's exercise of discretion. And that may very well continue. So things like, there's a theory called the unitary executive, and the short version is, anyone who works for the executive branch works for the president, has to pursue the president's policies, and can be fired at will by the president. That's an incredibly radical proposition from the perspective of how our government works, but it's actually not all that radical compared to what the Roberts Court has already said in cases in the past 5 years. So I expect the Trump administration to win some of these arguments. The second part is what I mentioned before, delay. In some of the things, they'll get mixed rulings or even negative rulings, but they won't care because they'll accomplish what they wanted to accomplish and be perfectly happy. The third outcome is that there can be some areas in which the court, and again, we're waiting to hear from the Courts of Appeal and the Supreme Court, and the longer they keep us waiting, the more like a crisis this will feel.
Right.
The third possibility is that the Supreme Court will say, no, you may not do X. And I think the easiest one is probably the birthright citizenship thing. I think it's entirely likely that the U.S. Supreme Court will say, no, the president does not get to define what birthright citizenship means under the Constitution. Only we, the courts, get to have authority to interpret the Constitution, which is a longstanding principle.
Sure.
So I think he'll lose that one, just to take one example out of the list.
Yeah.
but those first two, the fights that he'll win and the fights that he'll lose, but lose in ways where it's too late to undo the effects, I think, you know, in a lot of those, the administration will get a great deal of what it wants. And in that sense, this will not be a real constitutional crisis. It will just push the boundaries and come increasingly close to one.
Okay.
And that kind of hardball brinkmanship, that's exactly how Trump negotiates. That's his comfort zone.
Yeah, nothing new, really. What did you make, Howard, as somebody who observes the court, what did you make of Chief Justice Roberts' comments over the weekend, after Donald Trump and people in the Congress were calling for the impeachment of this district judge who is blocking things, Justice Roberts comes out and says, no, that's not how we do it. That's what the appeals process is for. Should people read any more into this other than this is a Chief Justice citing the law?
I think not. I mean, I know a lot of observers have been saying, aha, this is a signal from Roberts that he's planning to smack down Trump and declare the, you know, restore order and bring everything back to status quo, what it was 5 years ago. I don't think that's right. It's sort of like the birthright citizenship. There are some things the Trump administration can try to do that this court will say, no, we're not going to stand for that. Okay. And one of them would be the wholesale or even the targeted use of impeachment as a political remedy against judges and popular rulings. But one way to read what Roberts was saying is a message to Trump saying, look, don't worry about it. Go through the appellate process, bring this to us in a proper way, and in proper time, we're going to give you some victories. Just let's wait, you know, give us time to work this out. But, you know.
Just do it the right way.
There's no need to go rogue. Sorry?
Yeah, just do it the right way. Don't go rogue and things may work out for you.
Do it the right way. There's no need to go rogue and impeach judges. Go through the process. And, the way I read it, because of the comments I just made before, I think Roberts, in particular, he individually, is quite poised to give the Trump administration a significant amount of what it wants. And so I read that as much as a reassurance. As a statement of defiance.
Well,
but the thing I keep coming back to. Oh, sorry.
It's Howard. Unfortunately, we got to go. It is always great talking to you, and I know we'll be reaching out again because somehow I don't think any of this is going to get settled in the next couple days.
This story is definitely not over. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again. That's Howard Schweber. He is a professor emeritus in law and political science at UW Madison. We'll do this, then come back. It's Spanning the State. On the other side of the news, we will, of course, spin around the state. And then the big question becomes, what has happened to manners? We'll get to that and so much more. But first, we must do news on WTMJ.